On today's episode, we have Davis Clute. Davis runs an Amazon e-commerce store doing just under $25 million per year, and he's only 26. His brand, Hiccupop, was started 5 years ago while he was a junior at Stanford, and since then, they've obviously seen tremendous growth. So, if you want to hear how he did it and some other awesome stories about his trips to China, stick around, and I hope you enjoy.
You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast, weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning into the Next Generation. On today's show, we have Davis Clute. Davis, am I saying your last name right?
Yep.
Awesome. Davis, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Davis, before going ahead and jumping in, we've got a handful of topics that we want to go and dive into. Would you mind just giving like a 30 to 60 second overview on, you know, who you are, what you've done, and what you're kind of looking to go into?
Yeah, my name is Davis Clute. As they mentioned, I run a business called Hiccupop. We design, manufacture, and sell baby products. I've been doing it for close to 5 years now. I got into that because my parents were in the industry, so it was kind of my unfair advantage, and I wanted to start a business. I started another business before that we could talk about later. We do a little bit under $25 million a year in revenue right now, and we sell online exclusively and almost entirely through Amazon.
Wow. we've sold on Amazon a little bit, but not at that scale. So I got to imagine that you have plenty of interesting stories to kind of go with that. I'm really curious
Amazon's
about your,
a beast.
It definitely is, your background with kind of education in Stanford. Do you think that was an essential role in starting your business in like the traditional education, or, you know, looking back, could you have gone without that?
That's a good question. And as a final thing about me, to the previous point, I'm also the author of a book, How to Start a Business in 50 Pages. And so I'm sure that'll be woven as well. But that's something new I'm trying. So we'll come to all that. But that's a good question. Honestly, I don't think traditional I think it helped. I don't think it was critical. I don't think it was critical. Probably more so the driver was being raised in an entrepreneurial household. And just kind of a willingness to go after it. Maybe that's just a personality disposition, but I will just kind of go after things and I'll fail and fall on my face. And I don't get that embarrassed that easily. So that's probably more so in the education. It's helped from a marketing perspective. That's been like the number one thing is like, it's just sexy that I get to say I went to Stanford. But in terms of underlying, like learning about business and entrepreneurship, to some extent, it's helped, but I wouldn't say that's the main form that I've learned, you know, business-wise.
That makes a ton of sense. And I know, like, in terms of, like, drive and, like, dedication and that kind of stuff, I know there's a lot of different studies out there that says that, like, drive and the willingness to fail and on all of those kind of characteristics are kind of, like, the main attributes as to what does differentiate people who are successful or not. Now, when we were talking last week and kind of, like, getting to know your background a little bit more, you did mention that you had started a business, you know, prior to the one that you're running today.
Yeah.
would love to know a little bit more. We didn't actually dive into the details last week. So Gio and I are actually kind of going into this one cold, but would love to know what that business was and the story behind it all.
Yeah, it was my first love. But it was a business I started. I started as a sophomore. I was thinking about the idea, and then I had a friend who was really enthused about it, and I was like, okay, dude, let's do it. And he had a lot of energy for it. He was a good friend of mine. And the business was that we would give away red Solo cups, literally party cups, like plastic cups. We would give away plastic cups to fraternities, sororities, and student groups at different colleges because they have an insatiable demand for party cups, right? That's all they are. So we would give those away to student groups, again, fraternities, sororities, et cetera. And then we would sell physical advertising space on the side of them. And then effectively, it's a spread business. Our cost would be the cost of the cups, which is almost nothing. And then the revenue would be whatever, the income would be whatever we could sell the physical space for, like a 2x4 space on a cup for this demographic, for 18 to 22-year-old male, female, you know, upper income or whatever, middle income, et cetera. That was the business. And I liked it. It was very like capital efficient. It was very obvious how it would be profitable. We didn't raise any money, et cetera. So I liked it. And we got, as you can imagine, we got a lot of frats and sororities, more so fraternities to sign up and student groups. We probably had close to 500 people signed up, like that we had contacted, confirmed, email, everything. It failed because I didn't know that much about business. I was so wet behind the ears. I just didn't know anything about business. And so that was the business. That was the idea. We did about year and a half. We called it Zuul. And we actually had, we sold one product, so to speak. Like, we sold about 5 or maybe 10,000 cups to a mobile app that was wanting to advertise at the University of Washington fraternity system. So we sent like 5 or 10,000 of these plastic cups to UW, like the frat system there. And I actually have a photo of it, so I can, you know, show you guys later. But it was just a mobile app whose users were college age kids.
So why, like, what happened with that? So you kind of scaled it out, it worked, and then I guess what didn't really work?
Scaled it out is generous. Like, we sold one iteration. Like, it was an app called What's Goodly. I don't know if you guys know that app, but I knew the founder, but they probably had a couple hundred thousand users and raised maybe a couple $1 million. So we sold one product. We sold one like cycle, so to speak, to What's Goodly for maybe $500. It was $500 in revenue. And we did that, and I guess it was a success. We didn't really know if it was a success or a failure in terms of, you know, app signups. Maybe they knew better. But honestly, it got to the end of a year. We had sold once. We had $500 in revenue, but we had sold once. We didn't know enough about business, and we were getting back to school. The school year is starting. We were just like, my friend Kyle and I, my co-founder, we were just like, okay, let's just go back to school. We were interested in the idea, but it just, for a variety of different, like, more so personal reasons, we were just like, okay, dude, we've spent a lot of time doing this. It hasn't gone that far. Maybe we just kind of take our learnings and it's like a great learning lesson and we just move on.
That makes a ton of sense.
Honestly, I knew nothing about business. I was overconfident. I knew nothing. And we also thought that we should manufacture the cups in China, which is what you might think. You would think, okay, you could manufacture in China. That's where you put the ads. But we realized relatively late in the business that there are people in the US who, they'll make plastic cups, whatever graphic you want on them, and will drop ship them to the fraternity, which is way simpler. It's a shorter lead time. Maybe it's slightly more expensive, but it's a shorter lead time, simpler everything. But we realized that just too late. And at that point, I think we were just kind of burned out. And we had I just knew nothing about business. That sounds like a cop out, but
sure. No, but it makes,
I never started a business.
it makes a ton of sense. And I know, like, so obviously it's really cool to see how far you've come, you know, $500 in revenue on Red Solo cups, going over to an 8-figure business on Amazon with Hiccup Pop. And I definitely want to talk about Hiccup Pop a lot more too. But right before we actually go in transition there, I would love to know, like, someone is probably listening to this right now. They're in college. They might've just graduated college. Like, what are some of those key learnings, right? You keep on saying, I didn't know much about business. Like, what are some of the things that you've learned from then to today that have really differentiated you? And if you can give advice to someone who is 22, 23, starting off in a similar spot where you were before, what are like the one or two things that you would have them go and learn and study to actually go and get good at business and actually not just be that cocky, you know, college kid and actually feel like they've got a little bit of an understanding of how things work?
Totally. It's a good question. I would say you just got to do it. You got to, you're going to learn by doing. So you just got to, don't learn and reflect, but you got to do it. You got to release something. So I'd say do it. That's how you're going to learn more. Even if it feels imperfect, you got to fall on your face and get used to that and do it. The other thing I'd say is don't spend a lot of time in development. Come up with an idea and reflect, but don't spend 8 months perfecting your idea. Like, figure out something that you can release quickly. That will show you the whole cycle of like developing the product idea, developing the product if it's a physical product, and also marketing. Marketing is often the long pull for most businesses. So I would say just do it, and also don't spend a lot of time in development. Like, just release something and look at the first attempt. Don't be super idealistic and stake your whole vision, life, everything on it. View it as the first attempt that it is, like the sandbox attempt that it is, and just view it as kind of part of that process and say, okay, this will be a learning process. We need to deploy quickly and then move on from there. Highly iterative, highly, highly iterative.
I think that definitely makes sense kind of from what we've, you know, seen ourselves. I think we've tried so many different projects and failed on so many of them, but the biggest takeaways are definitely, you know, the things we've learned from them. And then how do we apply that next time? So you guys came, you went back to school. And then what, so how did you end up starting Hiccupop from there? So your parents were in the baby industry and you just kind of decided you want to take that online or?
Yes. And after it was probably junior year or something that we shut down Zool or killed off Zool, whatever you want to call it. But probably 6 months after that, I started Hiccupop. And it was just, I really like product design. That was always like a personal passion of mine. I kind of gravitated towards that. And that, like I said, I grew up around the industry, product design, patents, again, a lot of physical product-based stuff. So even, you know, litigation, things like that. So I felt that was my comparative advantage and I wanted to start another business. Honestly, I learned so much from Zool. As soon as I learned it, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to just start the next business. Like there was not like an ounce of me that had, exactly. I had zero doubt that I couldn't do it 10 times better the next time. And I wanted to start another business. And that, like I said, I just kind of looked at my, my advantages, my relative advantages. And that's what I found. And so there's as.
Would love to hear the actual story of like what happened, you know, day one, right? You get a group of friends, you have two other co-founders, right?
Yep.
So what did day one look like? What was the first product that you launched? Like what did that all look like?
Yeah, I'm really curious on the first product as well.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a few things all around like how we started it, et cetera. But the first product was a foam bed rail. And it was literally it looks like a speed bump that you put on the side of the bed. And it was because metal bed rails are harder to install. And so a foam bed rail is just literally easier for parents to install, but it still keeps kids from falling off the bed, from rolling off the bed specifically. That was the first product. The first version sucked. It really was not good. And that was impatience on my end. You learn a lot from that too, rolling out products. Yes, you got to deploy quickly, but deploy quickly in the sense of not biting off more than you can chew, not like just, releasing something haphazard. So the first version totally sucked and I was impatient. And then we iterated through that. We went on to version, you know, 4 or 5. But the way we came up with that product too, the way it happened was I was getting advice from my parents and my other co-founder, and basically somebody else was selling a very similar product. We didn't come up with the first foam bed rail. Somebody else was selling a foam bed rail. There was some problems with it, and there were some, but it still had a decent amount of sales, but there were problems with it. They didn't market it well. They didn't present it well, the branding, et cetera. And so we looked at that and we're like, okay, we could fix a few things on that. And that was really the logic and the decision behind the first product.
Did you know that you wanted to sell on Amazon originally, or did you come up with a product and then figure out what channels to sell on?
That's a good question. We came up with, let me think to that. We looked at a million different things, by the way. We looked at like baby products. Actually, it's not like I thought of baby products that immediately went into it. I just had a sense that I knew something about that, but we looked at a ton of different things. Like I was looking at, I think I was investigating like the costs of wine coolers at one point, like refrigerated wine coolers and importing those and selling them. And we looked at massagers, like at-home massagers, and probably
like the Theraguns, for example.
Exactly. Slightly different, but like, yes. And in that same exact, not the Theragun proper, but yeah.
When you're doing this research, I know a lot of Amazon sellers use the software Jungle Scout. Is it all through Jungle Scout. Or were you kind of going a different path?
That's a good question. We used Jungle Scout a lot in the early days. And so we looked at a ton of different options. It wasn't only baby products. We were kind of looking at anything, and I was looking at anything physical product related. And it just kind of bubbled to the surface that after like a super messy process, it was more art than science, that we just looked at this bed rail and said, okay, this seems like a comparatively good bet. Like there's not a lot of tooling. It's relatively easy to release. There's already demand for it, but it's not that great of a product. So like those overlapping Venn diagrams and it's maybe a small MOQ. Like, again, it's literally a piece of foam. So that was, those overlapping Venn diagrams kind of led to that, but it was really messy. It took multiple months. We, not in a bad way, but we just threw a million things at the wall and that kind of stuck. And it wasn't as straight line from baby products as I maybe think in retrospect. It, even after five baby products, we were still thinking, oh, maybe we get into something else. But in retrospect, it seems obvious, yeah, just go straight baby products.
So yeah, I know for example, like with Giovanni and myself, like we were selling cell phone accessories for 2-3 years or something like that on Amazon. And it got to the point where we were scaling up, we were selling a couple hundred a day. And like him and I would keep on looking at each other. We're like, okay, these are profitable, right? Like we make these things for next to nothing. We're selling them for a really good multiple on Amazon. And consistently throughout the entire time of us being in that process, we never really thought of ourselves as a cell phone accessory brand. And I think Amazon kind of does that disservice to a lot of different brands, right? Like at the end of the day, we had a brand, it was called Cardly, but the entire time we were like, we should launch water bottles. We should go and launch these other products. Like we're finding all of these random products that have nothing to do with our specialty and being like, no, we just sell on Amazon. We don't actually have a brand. And I feel like there's a big misconception there.
Absolutely. And I think to your point, that also hints at a good point that like starting a business is fascinating. It's, you learn, like I said, I'm starting to do the book now and I have a few other ideas. You learn everything. You learn something new each time. And that stuff just takes form over time. It just like over, it seems obvious that maybe you guys should only do cell phone carriers, you know, like Cardly proper in retrospect. And you guys did well with it, obviously. So that sounds obvious in retrospect, and maybe it's obvious I should have done baby products only, but it just, business, it's never a straight shot, and you two know that. It is always such a zigzag and like so much chance and like, not chance in a bad way, but almost spontaneity, like opportunism too. So that's hard as well. You need to show a lot of patience through that.
Did you know that you wanted to definitely sell on Amazon? Because I think the way we fell into it was almost by accident. We ordered just way too many products and then had no idea what to do with them. And then we walked around campus and selling them. And then we were like, all right, let's put them on Amazon and see what happens. But it's funny looking at it back now.
The most embarrassing story we had too, to Gio's point, sorry to interrupt you, was we literally went to the Boston Marathon because we thought like, hey, we're in Boston, let's go and sell these things like just to people there, right? Let's go to the Boston Marathon and try to go and sell these. And nothing more embarrassing than standing next to like a huge crowd of people and trying to sell Boston branded phone pockets to everyone who loves the city of Boston. And we get one sale for $7. And like at that point, it was like the lady gave us the money. I think Gio gave it back. We're just like, you know what? Like, just it's fine. Pity, like we get it. Yeah.
But so it was definitely like, awesome, you know, we kind of did everything we could think of from a sales strategy. And Amazon's what, you know, what stuck. And then we dove into, okay, now how do we rank on Amazon? And it seems like now it's a bit reversed. I think people kind of look at Amazon and they're like, all right, we're going to start an Amazon business. We know now how to rank. So where did you guys fall in that spectrum?
That's a good question. I guess I didn't answer that to the previous. We were more so the latter of starting with Amazon than going from there. Because I also knew a little, I was interested in e-commerce for whatever reason in Amazon. And I had a couple friends, like somebody's, a friend of, it's hard to explain, but a friend of a friend had sold on Amazon a bit. So I talked to him and learned a bit about that. So it was probably more so the latter, is we looked at Amazon first and then we're looking at like wine coolers, massage items, a million random things. And we probably had like a million brand names too. Hiccupop doesn't mean anything. It's a completely made up name. And we probably had 1,000 different brand names looking at. So more so the latter to your question.
Yeah, we struggled with that so much, coming up with brand names and company names. So, and that was so difficult to do.
Davis, totally. I know I talk to different people every single week about them trying to start a company. And I think mentally the hardest part is putting up their own money to go and try to make more money. I think, you know, people are so willing, and I don't want to sound like, you know, so I'm like, personal finance guru on Twitter right now or whatever. But like the fact of the matter is, like, people are so willing and don't think twice about, you know, paying $1,200 for the newest iPhone, but won't put up a few hundred bucks to actually go and create a product that can go and make them more money. Just curious, that first initial order run, I know there's probably some tooling costs in there, so maybe we can talk about that too, but what was the general amount of money that you and your partners had to go and put up to even get started?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I had something to say about the previous topic, but I raised $100,000 from effectively my parents. So it was like a pure friends and family and pure like parental, you know, round. Raised $100,000. I think we only needed about 50 or 60 of it to start, but raised $100,000. And that was just kind of them on a flyer taking a chance on me. That was like just as their son. And so that's financially how the business started. In the initial product, we probably bought like 3,000 or 4,000 bed rails. Whether it was 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 bed rails. That was the initial product, and we just went from there. And it was also a lot different launching products on Amazon back then than it is now.
Completely.
But those were kind of the finances of the early business. And we actually haven't raised any money since then. The only way you could do that, obviously, is like good gross margins for cash flow. But those were the finances of the business. And I heard another thing to your previous point. You were saying it's hard. People have a tough time putting up money for starting a business, right? I think, yeah, putting money into your own business will always be worth it. Not if you're like, you need to feed your kids or something. Then I would recommend a little more middle of the road approach. But you learn so much from starting a business. It's always worth it to put some of your money up. And I've heard a couple of people say, it's good advice. I see what they're saying. They say that you should never build a product unless you have somebody who's willing to give you pre-revenue right now. Like until somebody, if you can't sell a product through words or diagrams or a video, if you can't sell that to somebody right now and they're willing to commit with money, then maybe you haven't hit on something that's truly a problem. And so, or like really good product market fit. So that's a very scrappy, but like good approach. I see his point.
Yeah. And I know for the product market fit standpoint, yeah, the point that I always go and talk or hear about online is like, when you show your product to your customer, you either want a, no, I'm all good on that. Or like, you want a fuck yeah. Like you don't want like, that's nice. Yeah. Cause anyone you show this to, like by nature, nobody wants to be mean. No one's going to tell you that this thing that is your baby that you just put all of this time and money into isn't great. Like at the end of the day, they're going to say, oh, that's nice. But in reality, you want like a, no, can I actually just buy this off of you right now?
That's funny. That's a skill unto itself. And to kind of learn, you don't want to sell, my friend jokes, he's like, you got to sell vaporware. And you don't want to be like somebody like the Theranos founder or something where it's like complete vaporware and hundreds of millions of dollars. But you should in some way, like you want the market to ask for the product before you build it. Because there's been tons of stuff that I've built and that people have built where you spend all this time building and nobody wants it. And that is like the worst case scenario. So learning that cadence, that's a skill unto itself.
That's the classic Tim Ferriss one, I think. I've never actually done it, but he always talks about making like a website with a fake, you know, add to cart or buy button. I think there's a couple other ways to go about that. But yeah, trying to gauge that demand before you buy a bunch of products is definitely helpful.
Totally. And I actually heard a really interesting example. It's from a guy named Ryan Fitzpatrick, and my friend turned him on to him. But he had a point. He's saying, you know, if you want to build a cookbook, say you want to build an electronic cookbook for an iPad or something, right? That's just your product. One way to do it is to write the cookbook, build it, even if it's a simple version, show it to somebody and say, what do you think? That's one way to look at it or to approach it. The other way to approach it is you don't build anything and you ask them, when was the last time you bought a cookbook? And then if they say, why would I buy a cookbook? It's all free online. That's like a massive issue. Like you should know that before you build something.
100%.
Instead, you know, oh, I go to the physical store all the time, but I really wish there was a more digital version. Then you have some confidence in what you're building. So I like that cookbook example. And that's a skill I'm trying to learn as well. It's hard. But to Gio's point, there's a million different ways to do that.
Yeah, that's smart. So Davis, one of the things that I put out today is on Twitter, I just kind of tweeted, I was like, hey, I'm interviewing a founder today doing about 8 figures on Amazon. What should we ask him? And I got a ton of good responses. I'll send some over email to you later on. But I got this one guy to respond to me. His name's Mike, and he's doing 8 figures as well on Amazon, totally different industry, whatever. but he's super smart with how Amazon works and how they operate. And we know, obviously, there's probably some crazy war stories that you can tell us too. But from a pure business standpoint, last time we talked, you were telling me about how you've kind of like, in a weird way, like not in a weird way, but like in a cool way, like falling like in love with the accounting side and the operational side of a business.
Totally.
It's so important. Can you give an understanding to the audience as to like what your general margin looks like operating on Amazon, and like overall, like what are like some of your biggest operational expenses? Because part of the hardest part about like basically selling on a marketplace is you're reliant less on brand, and you have to consistently stay competitive, whether it is through product features, reviews, or price, right? So like, how has been on a marketplace, I guess to simplify the question, impacted your margins, and what as an Amazon specific business is like your largest operating expense?
Yes, that's a good question. Being on a marketplace, some of our stuff is obviously more competitive than others. I think we've done a good job at offering great customer service and making kind of cute branding and cute, just kind of cute branding around it, which allows you a little more leeway. To an extent, you're only a commodity product to the extent you believe you are. Like some people treat themselves as commodity products, so you will be a commodity product. Like if you, the founder, can't don't think your product deserves extra margin, there's nobody else who will, like flat out. I think a quick example of the cost structure of our business, and then it also talks about OpEx and such. Take our booster seats, an inflatable booster seat. I have a lot to say about the product design behind it. And we actually got into a lawsuit, a patent infringement litigation around it, which was also like interesting. But we sell the booster seat for about $30. I don't know the exact number, but call it 30. We sell it for 30. Amazon takes about approximately 10, which is about a third of the revenue. Then we get back, if you think about it, $30 is the gross revenue. Amazon takes 10. So our net revenue is 20. Like that's what we get in our bank account. But anyways, sell for 30. Amazon takes 10. The cost of the product landed in the warehouse is about 10. So maybe it's $8 or $9 FOB China. But then it takes $1, $1.50 to actually transport it and land it in the warehouse. So the landed cost is 10. And that would leave...
Davis, FOB for anyone who isn't familiar with Amazon and importing terms?
FOB just means it's the cost of the product on the ship. Like on the ship in Shanghai, what's the cost? And I think it stands for freight on board or free on board, but it's the cost on the ship. And so then... Amazon takes 10, the Chinese supplier takes 10, the cost, the COGS, the cost of goods sold is $10. Then, you know, our gross margin or net, if you think about it, because we don't have a ton of overhead, but an overhead meaning salaries or leases, you know, electricity, we then get $10 profit. The only other big expense to take in there is if we get about 3% returns, that's another dollar subtracted. 3% of $30 is 90 cents, and it's actually a little more than $30 each return. So if we get $10 of gross profit, take out another dollar for refunds, and then maybe another dollar or only 50 cents for like salaries of customer service people, my office lease, things like that.
Super interesting.
So that's kind of the cost of the business. And then all of that money, all of that, say it's $9 or $10 profit, we just keep that all in the business, right? And the tricky part is, even if you keep it all in the business, you can invest it all into inventory. You could have none of your profits in cash, but you still owe taxes on it. It's not like the government cares what you do with the money. It's like if you own a stock and you get dividends and you reinvest it, the government doesn't care what you do with the money. It's irrelevant to them. So anyways, that's also another consideration to take out. Your cash, you may not have a lot of cash in your bank account. You could have high profits, but not a lot of cash, and you still owe taxes.
Yeah, it's absolutely brutal. We're well familiar with that.
It sounds like it. So that's kind of the cost structure of the business. And I bet for every $6, I actually know the ratio, but maybe for every $8 in sales, we tie up about $1 in inventory. Just in the sense that you need to pay a supplier, you tell a supplier, I want 10,000 units. You need to give them some money now or at some point, then you pay for it, but you don't have it yet. It hasn't actually sold. So that money is stuck in your business. That's your working capital. That's kind of frozen money. So that's kind of some of the margins around the business and the cost structure of the business.
So with the money that you guys are keeping, what sort of levers are you pulling on? Are you putting most of that towards inventory, like you were saying, or is it going towards PPC or R&D? Where does it flow?
That's a good question. Mostly inventory. And we do a decent amount of PPC. And my partner actually does a lot more of, he's like a CMO, I would describe him. So we use that money for PPC, but I also don't want to use it indiscriminately and just buy revenue. I think sometimes people can fall into that. And so some PPC, not R&D isn't necessarily a cash expense, only because it's just time. It's being smart about how you're approaching something, and it's meeting with moms. It's literally just coming up with a prototype, meeting with moms, and just getting feedback and learning more about the product design process. Like I post on LinkedIn recently, when I went to China, I go to China a ton. I went to a city called Xiamen in southern China. I was sleeping with bed rails every night, like children's bed rails. I would put them in my bed and sleep with different versions every single night. And we went through like 15 prototypes in 2 weeks. It's kind of hilarious. I had a photo. I had 9 foam bed rails. It's actually the first product we came out with. It's the 6th version now. But I had like 9 of them in the corner of my hotel room. But anyways, most of the money, to the extent we're buying more inventory, most of the money gets tied up in just buying more inventory. And I think it's good also to have a cash buffer. So keeping cash is good.
So that's, first of all, you're going to have to send me that photo after this podcast, because I'm sure we're going to need some really, really nice cover art of you sleeping in China with 9 foam bed railings. One question that I had is, I know that when we were running Cardly, we had a pretty actually favorable position where like the cost of goods sold was dramatically less than what we were actually selling it for, which is really nice.
That's cool. I bet you guys had high margins.
I mean, we were selling silicone phone wallets, and
this stuff is
affordable for us. But without diving too much into there, the one thing that I always knew that we kind of still regardless had issues with was cash flow. And because of the fact that you're buying literally tens of thousands of products months before you're selling them, and then you're bringing them over and holding them down, probably the best moment in our business was when we built up enough of like a 2-year relationship with our supplier that we completely switched over the terms of our payments. So we like actually started seeing cash accumulating in our bank account, because no longer did we have to go and put down 30% and then 70% upon shipping. We then started putting down 15% on another 15% on shipping, and then 70% once it actually arrived. So that changed the way that we were going and operating, and like actually freed us up a ton of cash and working capital. Would be curious to hear like any advice you'd have for e-commerce sellers who do have a lot of inventory that they have to keep on hand, how they can go and manage that cash flow.
It's a good question. I think going to China physically helps a lot. Physically meeting them, they'll often give you a lot of lead time or a lot more leeway. And also really quick for your viewers, the essence, by what we mean cash flow, is the flow of cash over time, right? Like, when do I get my revenue in and when do I have to pay for the product? Sometimes in certain businesses, in industry trade groups, like when you're doing conferences, that number is actually, you have negative working capital because people are paying you before you deliver the product. So you're hosting a conference at the MGM Grand and you're paying for diners, like a catering service, but people are putting deposits down. They're paying for the conference before you actually pay your suppliers and pay the lease. That's the best case scenario, right?
And in the e-commerce, it's even as simple as dropshipping, right? It's the reason that it's the reason why people talk about dropshipping so much, is because you're having someone pay you, and then you're like, cool, now I'm going to go over to China and have them go and send it over to this person.
Exactly. So, anyways, the abridged version is that the issue for people like my business is we pay somebody in China, and then we only get the revenue 4 or 5 months later. That's your cash conversion cycle. That number can be relatively slow, and it's much slower for a railroad. That number's insanely slow, or a movie or something, but a Hollywood movie. Anyways, meeting people physically in person is great, and often I recommend, when people say, "How do I find suppliers?" We found suppliers on Alibaba. I would say you got to go physically meet them. You can do it without physically meeting them, but if you have the money and the time, and depending on what the business looks like, going to physically meet them in China, it's a fascinating journey. And it just alleviates a lot of problems long term, is having like a personal relationship and just seeing the physical facility, you know, the manufacturing facility.
You mentioned that also helped a lot with the actual product design, right? Where you kind of go to the factory and you kind of sit there with them and brainstorm and innovate.
Tons. And that's a good point. And that's something I definitely recommend to younger entrepreneurs. I'm just like, you got to prototype. You got to just cycle through prototypes. And so that when somebody asks, I have a product idea, what next? Like that, like at its most basic level, I have a product idea, physical product, maybe. What do I do next? I'm like, you got to prototype. And for us, we prototype in China because that's where we manufacture it. But it helps a lot to go over to China and sit at the factory floor and go through prototypes. You just got to go through prototypes because each iteration, you're like, oh, that's dumb. Why did I do that? Then you're like, oh, wait, that's smart. And then your supplier will say, hey, we have this other fabric. What do you think? Like, we have this really cool silk fabric or this really cool plush fabric, like Balboa fabric. And you'll be like, oh, wow, that's really smart. Let's do that. So it's got to be a highly iterative, a high shipping cadence, you know, of prototypes.
Also, that's really kind of one of the things I really wished we had done. It was a bit tough kind of in between classes and everything. And we would try to go over to go over for the big fairs in Hong Kong for a weekend.
Yeah,
But when we were, we would be sitting, you know, in our dorms or wherever trying to come up with products, and then we'd be sketching them out and we'd send it to the supplier, and then it takes a day and then comes back and we're up at like 3 a.m. trying to talk with them, and we got, you know, classes the next day. So it kind of became a lot, but like, imagine, like, you know, had we been there at the factory, I think it would have been a totally different, you know, game. At one point we were trying to do just even getting, you know, precise measurements and stuff. They send us samples, things don't fit. Now you're, you know, 2 months later and you realize that design was a bit off. So
you've got like 10,000 sitting in your warehouse, you know, and they're slightly off. Yeah.
On that note, I bet you must have some like really interesting stories on maybe your trips to China or horror stories of selling on Amazon or anything like that.
Okay, let me think. Probably I had a case one time. This is like at the extreme end of kind of a horror story. We ordered bed rails. This is as horror story as it can get really in China. We ordered 10,000. This wasn't a new product, but we had to switch suppliers because the old supplier was going out of business. Like something was not right with this guy's business. We switched to a new supplier that we found. It wasn't through Alibaba, it was through a middleman. But for your viewers, that distinction doesn't matter. We ordered, I think it was 10,000, maybe 8,000 bed physical metal bed rails. It was different from our first product. And we got the products here and they were all defective. Like literally 90 to 95% of these bed rails were defective. And we told the supply, and we had confirmed what's called a golden sample, like the last sample that they're going to produce to make sure it conforms. We got 8,000, you know, we got 8,000 bed rails here. They were almost all bad. We complained to the supplier and they say, no, it's fine. You know, your Americans are overreacting. I go to China. It was in a city called Ningbo. It's south of Shanghai, maybe an hour or so south of Shanghai. I go there and we said, hey, how about Davis comes along? I said, how about I come along? We determine what the true defect rate is because they had 1,000 extra units. They over-manufactured. So this was from the same production run, so to speak. And I said, let's put them together. Whatever the rate is that those are defective, you reimburse us for that. So if 90% are wrong, you reimburse us 90% of the initial order. Although if you think about it, if 90% wrong, all of them are wrong. Like I don't know where the 10% is. Anyways, that's the agreement. It's in writing. I go there. We put together the bed rails. It's like 87%, I think was the exact number. I knew that though. They didn't know that. It was 87%. And I say, okay, so we're all good. It took about an hour. I said, we're all good. You owe us 87% of it as per the agreement. And they agreed on the 87% number. And I say that to the guy. And he goes, oh, no, we can't do that. And I said, what do you mean? Like, do you not agree it's 87%?
Meanwhile, he goes, you're standing in mainland China right now.
I'm literally I am literally in a warehouse in Ningbo. And I was with a friend, like a friend came to visit me just for fun. Like, and so he was sitting in the corner watching this whole thing unfold. I say it's 87%. Then he just says, no. I go, what do you mean? And he says, no, it's too much money. And I said, I don't care. It's per the agreement. Like, this is what we agree. And he says, no, sorry. Like, we can't do it. And this, that's the start of literally a 7-hour drama of me in this factory. We just go back and forth for hours. It's a complete shit show. And at one point, the culmination of this is 5 hours into this, probably 5 or 6 hours into this, I'm talking to this guy. He's the general manager. He's not technically the owner, but he's the general manager. I'm sitting in his office and he's completely sick and tired of me at this point. He just wants me to go away. And then he goes in the middle of it. He's like, oh, by the way, I'm not the general manager. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm sitting in your office. Like, you're the general manager. And he goes, no, you know, I'm really just a friend of the owner. It's really just a ceremonial title. Like, I'm not really the guy you want to talk to about this. Like, this isn't really my ambit.
I'd be furious.
That's when I got mad. I was very cool and calm throughout that. But that was the point. I was furious. I didn't want, like, I'm sure I would have got arrested or something. You know, I'm in China by myself. But yeah, this guy to my face, complete dead, like no smiling, complete deadpan, was just like, oh, I'm actually not the guy you want to talk to. It's a ceremonial title. Sorry, I can't help you. But after 6 hours, I've been in this factory for 6 hours at this point. It is completely insane.
I can't even begin to imagine the frustration level. But like, one question I have is like, what was your expected outcome? Because I think like at this point, it's kind of standard knowledge that like, money really only flows one way into China, right? Like they can't,
yes.
they're not going to wire it back to you at the end of the day. Like if you send money over there, probably the absolute best case scenario is you find another manufacturer and they're able to wire it to another manufacturer over there. What was the thought process that they would reimburse it in terms of like giving you additional inventory that wasn't defunct, or what was like the expected outcome?
That's a good question. We were pushing for actual cash just because it was so outrageous. It was so blatant of an issue. 90% of these bed rails were defective. Two bars didn't fit together. It's hard to explain how the bed rail shaped, but two bars literally did not fit together. We wanted the cash back and we were pushing for that. We probably would have taken more inventory, like good inventory, obviously. But honestly, we were just pushing and they actually agreed to send back the actual money. Of course, they reneged on it almost immediately, but they said that they would as per however what percent. So really, I thought we would agree on the percent. I didn't really know what would happen from there. I like, for obvious reasons, I didn't quite trust the agreement. This wasn't written. This isn't like China, you know? I was just expecting to go there, agree on the defect rate, and then that they kind of made it seem like they would solve the problem from there, but they just completely reneged on it. Like, completely reneged. And then it was hilarious. One of the people, they kept telling me, the person I was dealing with the writing, she speaks English. Not everybody in the factory speaks English, but she kept telling me, no, like, please just forget about the agreement. Like that. I'm like, what are you talking about? That's the whole like reason I came over.
I'd be so what happened? What was the end result?
End result was that, and they kept saying how the day ended up was that they were like, oh, I think they thought I would leave because I had a train back to Shanghai at like 5 p.m. or something. I was there at that point 6 or 7 hours. And I was with my friend who had just tagged along purely for fun and our broker, the middleman who introduced us to the factory. And then I said, no, we're missing the train. Like, do not talk about the train. Don't bring that up because that's irrelevant right now. So we missed that train. Then we missed a second one at like 7 p.m. just to show that the factory, like we weren't just going to be like bullied out of it. Then at like 8 or 9, I was like, okay, we just need to go. This is ridiculous. And I just wanted the day to end. At the end, I was furious. I was really, really mad. But then we go back and forth. We tried to report them on Alibaba that it didn't really work. Then at one point I was just like spam calling the factory. I had a couple of the people's numbers from the US just saying, hey, how are you guys going to solve this? And then honestly, I think I just annoyed them enough that they sent us free bed rails. It wasn't even, they actually like sent us the free bed rails like maybe 6 months later.
There we go. I mean, yeah, I think at some point that's a testament just to pure persistence and perseverance. But yeah, I know I'm guessing it was never at the volume that you were at, but I know we've definitely gotten screwed on a handful of inventory deals with new suppliers. And that's why one thing that we always do before even going and wiring the remaining part of the deposit is we would always start bringing in formerly Asia Inspection, now I think QIMA, QIMA or something like that, like Quality Inspection Management for Asia. And so they'd go to all the factories and do like a full 30-page report and all that kind of stuff was kind of like the learning process after that. But that is definitely a wild story.
A horror story. It was insane. And I have less. So that's probably my most insane story, like as it relates to China. But I've had more run-of-the-mill stuff where just there was some production went wrong. I should have been on the production line for the first run, for the first time they made the product. But that is probably my most outrageous story as it relates to China. As it was happening, I was like, this is going to be an awesome story. Like, I think I had some presence. I was like, this is going to be absolutely hilarious to explain to people. But yeah, so Ningbo, China, if you're ever there.
So all right. So obviously, I think
Seedling was the factory.
Seedling, yeah. All right. If anyone's listening and trying to go and find some suppliers, ignore.
Do not buy Betterels from Seedling.
Yeah, that's going to be the big takeaway from the pod. All right. So I think there's kind of two sides to horror stories that we hear a lot about. It's the China horror stories, and it's like, you know, a supplier screwed you. You know, in our instance, we went over to a trade show before, and I know we were telling you about this on our call last week. Was like, we walked into a trade store, a showroom basically, and see all of our products laying out across a counter booth with the big sign that says like hot selling Amazon products. And it was basically then like about a 45-minute conversation with the factory where they said like, oh no, we're the manufacturer for Cardly. And we're like, yeah, we own Cardly. We have no idea who you are.
You're using my IP.
So yeah. So there was a whole series of events there. So I think, you know, everyone's heard these Chinese stories at some point or another. One thing I wanted to pick your brain on was from an Amazon perspective, right? I think I see a lot of stuff from other sellers about issues with Amazon, and I totally get that. I think that there's definitely some issues when it comes to Amazon Basics and when it comes to just the general like customer support and service that they give you, losing inventory, like everything really across running the business. But I'd be curious to hear your perspective on Amazon overall and what you think about it from, if someone has a product idea, should they go and start selling on Amazon today? Or do you think that you kind of hit this golden window of opportunity and it is probably not as prevalent as it might be today?
That's a good question. I would say, I think you can still sell on Amazon. I actually, the book I just wrote, I'm selling on Amazon. So hopefully there's still some runway.
Sure.
I would just say though that I've learned marketing is hard. And I actually, it was humbling for me releasing the book because the business, our business, Hiccupop, it started relatively quickly. We had tons of fits and starts and tons of issues, but it started relatively quickly. And when I tried to do that for my book, I realized how big of a part my co-founder was, the CMO, because he had experience selling on Amazon. So that was humbling, actually, to learn that I didn't do it all myself. I already knew that, obviously, but to learn that launching it on Amazon wasn't automatic. So anyways, personally, that was humbling and it was a good lesson to learn. It was a good lesson to learn. I think in terms of selling, my only advice to people would be like, think about how you would market the product without money. And if that's selling on Amazon, I think there still is opportunity on Amazon, but it's not linear. Like, you have to have some angle. You're not just going to buy ads, then the product's going to start selling. Nothing work. If it was that simple, everybody would do it, right? So that would be my only advice, is that it's not, don't rely on money to market and to launch your product on Amazon necessarily. And think about how you would market it just in general. It's not like you launch it on Amazon and people are just knocking down your door. That is not the way the world works.
Yeah, we definitely got lucky in the beginning. We had no idea what we were doing on Amazon and kind of learned it, as we went along. But I definitely don't think that's really possible now, though. Right? This is years ago, and I think if you go the Amazon route, it's, you have to be much more strategic, like you said about it, right? You have to still have all your marketing down. You got to really understand, you know, how the rankings works and the, you know, the reviews and everything. But so you also keep mentioning your book. Do you want to dive into that a little bit and, you know, discuss what that's about?
Sure. Also, out of curiosity, how did you guys launch your product? Did you just launch it and buy PPC? PPC for your viewers is like paid advertising, pay-per-click. But what? How did you guys launch it?
So the first, we originally, like, we couldn't even figure out how to fill out the form on Amazon to list a product. It was like battery type. We're selling a silicone product. We're like, I don't, like, no battery type, I guess.
Awesome.
And we took classic photos that we had like in the lecture hall on a desk is what we uploaded. And then I think we did maybe a little bit of PPC. And then all of a sudden we like woke up one day and we're like, oh, we have 5 sales. And then the next day we had like 8 and we're like, oh, all right, well, let's get better photos. And then, so that was kind of initially, we kind of fell on it. And then down the road, I think we unfortunately, I think got suspended too in the first month or two of the business, because we had all of our friends and family leave reviews. We had obviously, you know, didn't read the terms of service,
good.
Which was a horrible mistake to make on Amazon. And then down the road, it became everything from, you know, search, find, buy, and ManyChat stuff to a lot of PPC. Still mostly PPC. And the issue with the cheap product was it was never profitable, which kind of sucked. So I think we're spending, you know, thousands of dollars every week and you know, making no money on it.
Paid marketing oftentimes sucks.
It was no fun, but we got a lot of credit card points, which is cool.
you buy your credit card points for whatever it's worth.
would love to know more. So you have a book though now. It's called How to Start a Business in 50 Pages.
Yeah, and let's talk about that a minute. Then I think is another thing I wanted to talk about, the patent lawsuit with our booster seat. I think people are always interested in patent litigation. I think your viewers would be more interested in that. Although buy my book, that's 10 times more interesting than now. So the book can come in later, but the patent, it was actually the booster seat, the one where I talked about, you know, we sell for 30, Amazon takes 10, the cost of goods is 10, and then our gross margin in a sense is 33%, right? 1/3 of our revenue is profit. But what happened there was there was an existing person who already sold an inflatable booster seat. That's been around since God was a child, right? That's not like a new idea. And that she had 2 patents, a design patent and a utility patent. There's a third type of patent called process patents. I don't know much about those, but she had a utility and a design patent. And anyways, we knew about the patents, but actually how we were designing it had nothing to do with the patents anyways, because patents don't give you a monopoly on the general concept of a booster seat. They give you a monopoly on the specific application, like an inflatable booster seat with a one-way valve attached to an LED gyroscope at the bottom. It's like a very, by design, it's very specific. It's a very specific design that it gives you a patent for. Anyways, we designed the product. We just designed it totally different because we didn't like her product. There's nothing to rip off. I didn't like her product. But we came out with the product. And before we came out with it, we went to a lawyer to get a statement of due diligence just so they could say, hey, because we knew as soon as we came out, she was going to allege patent infringement. That is like 101 in terms of Amazon or competitors. So we went to an attorney just to get us a rubber stamp to say, hey, they did their research. There's no patent infringement as per my professional opinion to these 2 patents. Anyways, we came out with it. Within 24 hours, she tells Amazon that there's patent infringement and our product gets taken down because Amazon says, hey, there's patent infringement here. We're freezing all your sales, but we need to sort this out before we allow you to continue to sell. I don't know if that happened to you guys at all, but that's just selling on Amazon. Competitors will do dirty stuff like that. And we sent her a letter. As soon as we released it, we said, hey, don't go to Amazon and say there's patent infringement. We have this statement of due diligence. We did our research. If you do this, like, you're on notice. Like, you can't just allege there's patent infringement. You can't, what if I was selling a water bottle? You can't literally just say, oh, I
You literally warned her. You said, hey, we know what you're about to do. Don't do it because we got you red-handed.
And you sent that to her before you launched the product?
Yes. Or like the day of, but yes.
That's so baller.
it was also just like, that's also, it just like alleviates the issue. That was partly my idea. And I talked to our two co-founders and we said, hey, because people had done that to us before, alleging patent infringement. So this wasn't the first time this has happened to us. Anyways, we released it. We sent her that letter. She didn't respond. And 48 hours later or 24 hours later, she said, Amazon, there's patent infringement. Our product was taken down by Amazon because Amazon had to sort it out. Anyways, we then go back and forth with her. She doesn't withdraw her complaint and kind of games the system with Amazon. So we sued her and we filed a lawsuit. It's called interference in prospective business advantage. And what that means is she couldn't go to Amazon and tell them I abuse my dog or something, or I'm a racist, or that I allege on her patents. Like if that's factually incorrect, she is interfering in my business relationship with Amazon, my business advantage. So you can't do that. And there's people do that all the time, but that's grounds for suing somebody. And however much we lost in sales by her doing that fallaciously, we sued her for interference in prospective business advantage. She withdrew the complaint, but we kept up the lawsuit for those lost sales and reputational harm. And then we settled for maybe 20 grand.
Okay, I was gonna say, if it's a brand new product, how do you estimate the lost sales? Just like basically based on the BSR of other similar products, or
you get some attorney to just come up with the most like tenuous argument for the largest amount you can possibly think of. That's
lawyer costs times two.
Exactly. Then square just for like emotional squared, harm or something.
How long did that process take?
That's a good question. It was about a year and a half ago. I bet it took about a month until the product was actually selling, like until she had exhausted all of her avenues and she had withdrawn it. I bet it took about a month. Then the lawsuit, she was based in the UK actually, but she had an entity here because she sold in Amazon. So that's what we were suing for. We were trying to collect the money in the US because we weren't suing in the UK. She had sales in the US from Amazon. So we were trying to collect those receivable, like the money from Amazon is what we were trying to foreclose on. But I bet that took 6 months or so. And anyways, we settled it. And to me, that's insane. I may have told you guys this last time. She was saying, oh, you guys copied our product and this is my product and blah, blah, blah. Nobody has a patent on a general idea. Nobody has a monopoly on a general idea. And to me, it's insane. I'm just like, let's let the customer decide. Let's just stop the litigation. Let's stop the bad mouthing and stop the name calling. Let's just put our products on a table side by side and let the customer decide. That's what's fairest to the customer. And she's spending all this time complaining about us. She should have spent her time focusing on the product design. If she had just designed a better product and iterated through her product initially, I wouldn't have been there because there would have been, by definition, no hole in the market to enter. So that's an insane way to view life. I was kind of inevitable to her. I didn't think it was a very good product and the customers agreed. So
that's smart. It's definitely the better way to the better way to go and run the business, being able to go and focus on product quality, making the customers happy. I mean, I think the one comment I will make out of hearing this story is that I think that there's definitely a lot of, like I think from an Amazon seller standpoint, you hear a lot of people being like, oh man, like, you know, dealing with Amazon is so difficult, dealing with other sellers and like copyright and all that kind of stuff becomes very difficult. The one thing I got to say is that as the Amazon market continues to go and evolve and get bigger and get more competitive, is that it's actually like you being on Amazon is going to actually have some kind of a competitive advantage to your business. Because, you know, while you guys are willing to put up with lawsuits that are going to take a year and a half and 8 months to go and get refunded from, you know, sellers or manufacturers over in China, like not everyone's willing to do that. And so that does create a good amount of like barrier to entry where other people won't want to go and deal with all of the headaches. And they'd rather say, hey, you know what? I'm just going to throw up a Shopify store and deal with the shitty support that comes from Facebook when I try to go and run my ads.
And I do think also the part about you going to China, right? I think Amazon is definitely, for all of the negatives, it is forcing consistent product innovation. Like, right, most of the sellers, you go on Amazon, you find a product and you make it better. So generally, I think you do end up creating better products. And if you're actively able to do that at the factory, that's definitely a huge competitive advantage.
I totally agree. And the customer doesn't owe us anything. If they can get a better value somewhere else, they should. There is no annuities in business and in or kind of sinecures. And so I think it aligns things better. And to your point, so I agree. And to your point, Connor, the reason, a small nuance here, the reason the inflatable booster seat, that was my baby. That was my baby over probably a year. And the reason we got into it initially, I thought the current existing offerings, there were a couple, I thought they were really bad. I didn't think they really iterated through the designs well, but there was a lot of regulation around them. And we were just willing to take the time. I was leading through, so the standard for car booster seats in the US is called FMV 213. And it's the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, FMVSS, Clause 213 governs booster seats. And it was insane how much regulation, and we had to get it crash tested. They were regulating like the shade of gray on the car that came with the product. And we failed it actually initially. I like screwed up the graphic design. But we realized no other competitor would do that sort of research. Not research, but like patience to see things through over 8-12 months. So that was actually, not all products are like that, but that was one of the main reasons we chose that product, was we realized there just wasn't much competition.
What does a car crash cost?
Like a safety, you're saying like a safety test?
Yeah, do you know what that was?
Yeah, that's a good question. I bet we spent all in about 10 grand on testing before releasing the product.
That's insane. So I can only imagine there was just tossing these car seats all around.
I actually have a photo. It's like super creepy, the dummies that they show. They look like a Chucky doll or something. But we spent about 10 grand. I think we tested with a company called MG&A. There's different testing houses that it's a federal standard, but you don't test with the government. It's like a private company that you need to self-certify that you tested. And so anyways, about 10 grand, and I bet it took 6 months. It was insane. I couldn't even figure out where to get it tested. It like wasn't like, this wasn't like you just go into Google and type, you know, car seat testing, like, and it's like a web form to apply. Like I needed to call multiple people just to find somebody who did this. So
that's awesome.
It takes patience.
Yeah. And honestly, I was just about to say too, like, I think for anyone listening to this is just kind of another testament that like everyone wants to get rich quick and everyone wants to go and, you know, make money fast and be young and be rich. But like, patience is such a big competitive advantage. And if you're willing to go and actually just be like, you know what, we're going to go and work, we're going to iterate, we're going to keep on testing the product, but we're going to also understand that it might take a year to get a really good product out there in the market. And like, we just have to be cool with that.
Totally. And I heard like a funny quote. It's from a family friend, and the dad's very successful. And he would always tell me, he'd say, you know, people who try to get rich quick end up forgetting they could have gotten rich three times over by now. And I think that's like a good way to look at it. It takes time. Entrepreneurship takes time. It's very humbling. It's totally humbling. And so anyways, but that's the story behind this booster seat. And the worst part of it all, the product sell, it's good margin and the product was selling really well. We got great reviews, but we were selling it for probably only a year before COVID, and COVID has completely decimated sales because nobody's traveling. So, and it's a travel item inherently. So anyways, no good deed goes unpunished.
That's annoying, but I mean, hopefully once everything picks up a little bit, you'll see the traffic come back in. Are you guys getting patents on these? Do you have like kind of a law firm you always use? Or because we kind of looked into it and then it became really expensive really quickly and we focused on other things.
That's a good question. No, we have a couple design patents. Design patents aren't worth anything though. They're for strictly ornamental design. Like if you designed a t-shirt with stitches in a certain way, that would be a design patent, where a utility patent would be like a shirt, maybe with certain types of fabric sewed in a certain type of way, like dyed over 5 years or something. So utility patents is much more complex. That's typically what people talk about when they talk about patents, but no. We don't, because none of our stuff is patentable. You can't patent a ball, for example. And our stuff, we've thought about it and maybe a couple of them are, but we also iterate through design sometimes so quickly that we almost get past the current design that would have been patented. And also the other thing with patents that we could maybe do it, but patents are only as good as your ability to enforce them. It's not like you show somebody a patent and they stop selling. Like you gotta tough up. You gotta say like, I've got an attorney here and we're about to sue you. Like here's a draft of the complaint. That's how you enforce your patent. So it also, there's a lot of time and effort that takes in enforcing patents. So yeah, anyway, to answer your question, no.
No, and what you were saying is cool too, because it like it kind of shows that you guys are really committed to the product quality, right? Like if you guys are willing to go and consistently make product iterations and make design iterations, like the cost of and time of even first of all filing for the patent, let alone enforcing it, is just not worth the headache of just building a better product. At the end of the day, the better product wins.
And I think as a final thing on patents, I think that the competitor, the BoosterC competitor, she had a patent, like I said, design and utility patent. I could tell it was her first version. I could tell she had came out with a version, patented it because she thought that's what you do, and never iterated past it. So, because you could just tell the first version of a product where you're like, wow, I noticed a problem with this almost immediately. Within 20 seconds of using it, I could tell this is like a fatal flaw in the product. So, it can slow the pace down. Some people do it, but a lot of our stuff just isn't patentable as well. It's not like we're designing, you know, like rocket engines or something.
Yeah, something complex. All right, cool. Davis, I mean, this has been such an interesting conversation. The last question I do have for you is, so how old are you today?
26.
26. So, I mean, you got a lot of business years left ahead of you. What's next? What are you interested in? What are you focusing on? Like, where do you want to be, call it 10 years from now?
That's a good question. Okay. One is I wrote the book and I want to build a business around teaching. I really like teaching and I really like entrepreneurship, and I don't want those to be separate parts of my life. I want to build a business and make a lot of money off of teaching. So I incorporated a business, actually, an LLC is one of the three legal types. I incorporated a business. I put 30 grand of my own money into it. And the book is one of my first products. I want to build a business around teaching. I'm the only shareholder. It's in its earliest, most embryonic stages. But I have a few more ideas of products I want to build, all education and learning related. And making money off that. That's one thing that'll probably be like my life's goal, is like building that business. That another thing that's totally fun, I don't know if this will actually happen, but we actually develop a lot of software internally for ourselves at Hiccupop, like mostly around like analyzing cash flow, inventory management, demand forecasting, product iteration, like numbers and such. And I've been like interviewing people, like buyers and inventory planners, to learn about how they manage inventory and what software they use, because I wonder if some of our software could be built into a business if other people would use it. That's also in its most embryonic stages. And we actually tried a product. We call it Hiccusoft. Hiccupop is the baby. And we actually have a website, hiccusoft.io. But we tried a product already with it, semi-unrelated. It completely failed, but we want to try again. And who knows where it goes? It's too early to make any, there's no like grand promises, but I also, that'd be a fun experiment to try. I just know a lot about inventory management and running a business and cash flow wise. So anyways,
let's talk about that offline. Yeah, I was gonna say, well, Gio and I can talk to you a little bit more about that too, because we definitely had the same exact thought process on wanting to start that business. Inventory management was hands down the toughest thing to manage, especially when you have like 80 different SKUs.
Totally. I would actually be curious for you guys' input. So anyways, but let's talk about that later. But yeah, I think the teaching business, maybe Hiccusoft, but the teaching business is continue to run Hiccupop, but the teaching business is probably like long-term what I'm most interested in.
Awesome, man. Davis, been super interesting. If people want to go and learn more about you, check you out anywhere else. I mean, there's the book, right? So maybe send them to the book, but where else? Where can people find you?
I'm awful because I don't have like Twitter or Instagram or anything.
How are you going to teach people if you don't have the platform?
That's actually fair. Like I probably need to spend more effort on that. LinkedIn, honestly, is probably the best place. Like cool. A lot of my stuff, LinkedIn is probably the best place, and Davis Clute, you know, more or less how it sounds.
Love it, man. Davis, thanks for coming on the show today.
Cool. Thank you.